Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this post-holiday edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. Happy to have you with us today. Coming up on today's show, a special interview with Dick Sullivan. He is the current president and CEO of PGA Tour Superstore. He's been in that position since 2009, but he joins us to not only talk about his experiences there, the last year, and what that's looked like at PGA Tour Superstore, but he'll also talk about his past retail experience as the CMO at Home Depot, and also working with the Atlanta Falcons of the NFL, and how retail and his retail experience helped after Arthur Blank took over the Falcons and their leadership team swooped in, so to speak, pardon the pun. We'll also talk today about Walgreens, as we mentioned in our Looking Ahead segment last week, and we'll close out today by looking ahead to news that was potentially behind us in terms of Amazon potentially wanting to open up discount stores pre-pandemic, at least, in the exploration that was revealed. Bloomberg this past week will lead off our news segment today, however, with Joanne, as they released their fourth quarter results in their first earnings call since going public less than a month ago. A reminder, the obligatory one, that you can rate us on whichever podcast listening service you access us on, whether that be Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or any other podcast listening service, including Amazon Podcasts as well. Yes, we are there. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast, both Instagram and Twitter. Now, these results for Joanne were accompanied by their full year results. We got a little bit of their results, at least year to date, when their IPO or in the run up to their IPO. The call was delayed, this fourth quarter call, by their IPO. This quarter ended way back on January 30th, so some of these numbers a couple of months old. And the numbers that we got in the run up to their IPO suggested a strong sales year to date for them, following much of the rest of the crafts retail industry, which saw somewhat of a resurgence, especially in the period right after stay-at-home orders came out. People were spending more time at home. People were finding ways to occupy their hands. One such way was through crafting. Crafts retailer and Joanne competitor Michaels, of course, had previously seen strong sales really during the pandemic, post-reopening. General merchandise retailers like Walmart suggested that crafts were one of their stronger categories during 2020. Of course, you have the Crafter's Corner opening up in Dollar Tree stores throughout the nation. So we know this is a hot segment. With that backdrop, let's discuss their fourth quarter earnings. Now, this was not a call. This was just a press release. There was no call. There was no analyst Q&A. So we got limited insight into the numbers, which is why we're covering two news stories today. But Joanne's revenue did see a 20.9% increase over last year's fourth quarter. Comps saw a 21.2% increase. Obviously, strong results here for the retailer. In the scheme of things, bit of a pullback from earlier quarters. If you're looking sequentially, for example, their comp sales for all of 2020 were up 23.5% over 2019, but still a solid holiday season for Joanne. You look at that 21.2% increase on the comp front. Very impressive. What they call omni-channel net sales grew 194% over last year's fourth quarter. This is really kind of a misnomer. What they mean, of course, is sales touching digital channels. Omni-channel would, of course, refer to any channel in a literal sense, but some retailers and media use omni-channel as a proxy for digital channel. Anyway, pedantic gripes from me aside, sales touching digital increased to 16% of total sales. Very clear that most Joanne customers enjoy going to the physical stores. This is a number behind what you see from a lot of apparel retailers, a lot of general merchandise retailers. But overall, they are growing in their digital volumes. And this makes sense. You know, for people that operate in the craft space, oftentimes it's about interacting with the materials and going to stores as a way to get a vision for your crafting quest, whatever you might be into and whatever you might be doing. And as I talk to associates in Joanne and Hobby Lobby and Michaels, they say that a lot. You'll see people just kind of wandering through the fabric section, staring, looking for the right thing. It's tough to replicate that in the digital channel. Of course, you're looking at maybe equipment sales, maybe implement sales. You think about fabric scissor sales, for example, obviously touching digital a little bit easier in the digital sense, but sometimes no substitute for the physical stores, and Joann's physical stores seeing massive comp boosts and, of course, slight boosts in traffic as well. Meanwhile, their net income was solid, $38.3 million on $840.8 million of net sales. That works out to about 4.6% of sales, which was also a year-over-year improvement. When you look at their EBITDA, that increased 100 basis points as a percentage of sales as well. Substantial, and that's a big reason for their net income numbers popping as they did. Meanwhile, their interest expenses, as they have been for so many retailers that saw success during the pandemic, those were reduced somewhat during the quarter versus the prior year. So keep in mind, this quarter ended before their IPO, so we're not talking about IPO proceeds paying off debt. Strictly from all this influx of sales that they're seeing, the company's long-term debt decreased by over 35% by the time the 2020 fiscal year was up versus the end of 2019. So that's a great sign for them. Obviously, the IPO raised some funds. You're likely to see that long-term debt decrease again, should make it easier also to restructure debt going forward if that's something they're interested in doing. Overall, you're going to see a lot more cash on hand for Joann going forward because these interest payments aren't as substantial. Now, interestingly enough, after we spent the last several weeks discussing retailers for whom inventories were up for one reason or another, of course, Big Lots is one that comes to mind, but there are other retailers that we've discussed where inventories are up maybe because they want to make sure in-stocks are good, like in the case of Walmart. Maybe they're up because things are stuck in transit. Whatever the reason, Joann has actually gone in the opposite direction during the last year. Inventory was down 14.4% from the end of fiscal 19 to the end of fiscal 20. In dollar numbers, this reflects a decrease of $93.8 million. That's a huge number considering the massive jump in net sales. So really, I think that's the most interesting thing to come from this. Inventory's down around 15% versus last year. Sales up around 21%. What are the inventory dynamics going to look like going forward? Was this inventory that Joann ultimately needed to shed in order to stay competitive, in order to get their books in order? Or is it a matter of maybe struggling to source to keep up with this demand? Ultimately, when you see sales pop by so much and inventory decline by so much, might be a negative sign potentially for the next couple of quarters, but we don't know simply because there's no analyst Q&A. No one was able to ask management any questions regarding their inventory status and where they would like to be on the inventory front. Hopefully that will change for future quarters, but certainly a dynamic to keep an eye on going forward is Joann. Again, great quarter, but you wonder where their in-stocks are lying there or if this inventory reduction was intentional. Now let's move on to Walgreens. They released earnings as well. We're not going to talk so much about the numbers. It's the COVID vaccine traffic we're concerned with. As again, we talked on last week's show, many media outlets have been discussing the potential for COVID vaccination rollouts to pharmacies and to an extent grocery stores to potentially increase or boost revenue for these locations. Now for Walgreens, this latest quarter, their second quarter, finished on February 28th, 2021. So that was still somewhat in the early days of the vaccine rollout, but still by the end of the quarter, they had administered 4 million vaccines company-wide. They did note that during March, this number actually doubled. They administered 4 million in March alone. So you look January, February, they were able to double that number in March. Likely think those numbers are going to continue to increase in April as vaccines get opened up to a larger swath of the population. I know as of right now, where I'm at in Colorado, everyone can get their vaccine who wants their vaccine. It is open to the public, and there are people flocking to stores, to retail locations that have the vaccine in stock with a particular demand for that Johnson & Johnson vaccine that is a single-dose vaccine. Now, again, I say all of this to say that we should look ahead to the third quarter of 2021 for Walgreens with this in mind, as well as other retailers. But The number we were looking for here was the comp retail sales, as they call them, what most pharmacies call front store sales. We knew pharmacy sales technically would get a boost because of the COVID-19 vaccinations, because of the reimbursements there. But how did this affect the front store sales with this increase in traffic? Their numbers on this front, actually not good. And it's because of other macro factors, a 3.5% decline, in fact, on this front. That was more than offset, of course, overall by 4.5% comp increases in pharmacy. We're talking about U.S.-only numbers here. As a result, pharmacy sales now account for 74.9% of retail store sales in the U.S. overall. This is mind-blowing, nearly three-quarters after this number was just in the 60s a few years ago. Even when you eliminate tobacco and e-cigarette categories, front store comps still declined 2.7%. What was to blame here? Well, realistically, the flu was to blame. As noted by many media outlets, the flu had its worst year in a long time, likely because everyone was distancing, masking, staying home, etc., trying to avoid COVID-19, which had a spillover impact to people avoiding the flu. And as such, this negatively impacted comps by 350 basis points, meaning that if you exclude both tobacco and seasonal flu, comps might have been positive, but that's a lot of exclusions here. And that's all despite the influx of customers getting vaccines. When you look at other areas within the company, beauty took a massive hit too. It's easy enough to blame the flu and the fact that the flu wasn't as severe this year for a downturn in sales, but this was the most telling. Beauty took a massive hit for Walgreens at 8.8%. We've seen beauty categories fluctuate for certain retailers for different reasons. Obviously, a lot of dynamics there, but that's a big hit to take in a category that's not really touched by any kind of flu sales. And the company did note positive sales in health and wellness. Those were up 9.1% year over year, with that caveat of excluding the impact of seasonal flu. So they did well in health and wellness overall, but took a massive hit in beauty. And as I mentioned, that's an influx of customers coming in, getting vaccines, and really walking back out the door without buying much. And leadership did make it clear that traffic was positive and has been positive, continued to be positive, due to the vaccine execution. So other positives from the COVID vaccinations for them included script growth of 140 basis points as a direct result, of course, of those vaccinations. They get or are supposed to get around $40 for each vaccination going forward. Here you've got Medicare prices basically set, but it's unclear as to exactly how much they'll be getting from certain other providers throughout the globe. Their pharmacy market share, though, was down 30 basis points compared to last year's second quarter. Put them at 20.9% pharmacy market share in the U.S. Not something we're used to talking about is some of the bigger pharmacies in the U.S., Walgreens and CVS, market share declining for one of them, but it did for Walgreens. You have to think CVS, possible victor here, but maybe also companies like Walmart and Kroger. In an effort, though, to protect their market share, Walgreens has nearly doubled the number of associates qualified to administer vaccines, trying to help out with throughput there. They went from 30,000 associates that were qualified at the end of the first quarter to 59,000 at the end of the second quarter in the U.S. alone. But as I mentioned, not a lot of bottom line positives here. And in the end, it looks as though Walgreens is transparently bearish, in fact, on the impact that the vaccine might have, at least in the short term. Executive Vice President and CFO James Kehoe said on the call, in fact, that tight ongoing restrictions in the U.S. have offset any opportunity to profit off of this in the short term. And so despite vaccine reimbursement rates being around that $40 projected, they still project COVID to have a 13 cent per share negative impact going into the next quarter. He did note that they hope to turn this to a positive later in the fiscal year with continued vaccine rollouts and hopefully people getting out a little bit more, some of those local restrictions being eased up. Although I've got to admit that in most of the country, it seems like a lot of retail restrictions have indeed been eased somewhat. But they also noted on the call some of the restrictions surrounding how vaccines can be administered as well. So all of that to ask this question, what did we learn from this earnings call? Well, perhaps Walgreens isn't a great bellwether for how administering vaccines will impact U.S. retailers, but if they are, retailers may not see the impacts referenced by media outlets heading into March regarding the vaccine rollout. However, like I said, traffic was up, so that's a good thing. Perhaps a retailer who has a better front store proposition, like a grocery store perhaps, or maybe like CVS, who's performed a little bit better on the front store front than Walgreens over the last 5 years, maybe those retailers will see a greater benefit. Certainly something we'll be waiting with bated breath to see over the next couple of quarters as the vaccine rollout continues. Well, that does it for our news segment. Coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Dick Sullivan, once again, the CEO and president of PGA Tour Superstore. He'll talk about his career in retail, some initiatives that he's particularly proud of, as well as how his retail experience shaped his approach and leadership when he was tapped to be one of the members of the leadership team of the NFL's Atlanta Falcons when Arthur Blank bought them nearly 20 years ago. We've discussed how the pandemic caused an eventual surge in activity surrounding sporting goods retail as people sought not only to stay active, but also find activities that supported social distancing, and golf was one such activity, as was tennis. And golf, the sport, saw an unprecedented number of new players in the back half of 2020. Here to discuss what that meant for retail, as well as the dynamics of steering a retailer through a pandemic, as well as his retail career as a whole, is Dick Sullivan. He's been the president and CEO of PGA Tour Superstore since 2009. Prior to that, CMO of Home Depot, and also worked with the Atlanta Falcons of the NFL, among others. Dick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Trent. Great to be here with you.
First, I gave a really brief introduction, but I was wondering if you minded discussing a little bit more about your retail career to this point. Obviously, we know you're the CEO of PGA Tour Superstore, but what were some of the experiences that took you to this point?
Well, I think it would take a little bit longer than we have today, but I can tell you on the day that I turned 16, I started working at a grocery store. So I couldn't start before I was 16, but they had me shagging carts out in the parking lot, you know, some high profile job at a grocery store when I was 16 years of age. But I think if I accelerate forward, it was roughly 29 years ago that I was recruited by Home Depot, and Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus, the founders of Home Depot, moved from the Northeast. Grew up in Boston and worked my way down to Atlanta, and have been in Atlanta now for, as I said, almost 30 years, and was the chief marketing officer at Home Depot during tremendous growth of the Home Depot. At one point, we opened 200 stores a year, or a store every 43 hours, which is hard to envision, but we did that. And then Arthur Blank acquired the Atlanta Falcons in 2002, and 30 days after he acquired the NFL team, I moved over from my position at Home Depot to help run the football team here in town. And after a number of years and some other ventures that we got involved in, Arthur invested some money into the PGA Tour Superstore. I sat on the board, basically followed his money as an investor. And over a period of time, short period of time, we decided that this would be a really good business to add to the portfolio of businesses. We also have a Major League Soccer team, Atlanta United, and a stadium, as you're probably aware, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, one of the greatest stadiums in the world. And Arthur is chairman and I am CEO, and we've taken this business back roughly 10 years ago from a 9-10 store company to where we'll have 50 locations by later this year. And it's been quite a run, not certainly the growth curve that we had at Home Depot, but a lot of the same principles apply. We applied here at PGA Tour Superstore with associates, with customers, with the whole environment, the whole experiential environment inside of our stores. So we've got a great team of leaders here. We've got a tremendous amount of associates, over 1,000 associates from coast to coast, from California to New York to Florida and Arizona, and all in between. And as you know, and I'm sure we'll get into, the past year has certainly been an interesting year for lots of people, and certainly for the game of golf.
Before we talk about the last year, I did want to go back. I might have the years wrong, but you mentioned the growth at Home Depot. I think you were there from 1992 to 2002 as the CMO. What's it like overseeing that level of growth versus very meticulously planned growth that we've seen at the PGA Tour Superstore over the last 10 years?
I've been asked that question before. those years are somewhat of a blur, almost because of the energy, the excitement, as I mentioned, that type of growth. I mean, 25%+ store growth every single year. It seemed that we were on a treadmill of opening stores and growing internationally, had the incredible experience of expanding our business across the borders, certainly into Canada and elsewhere. And we also built a significant amount of proprietary brands over that period of time. So it wasn't just our brick and mortar stores. You know, there were brands like Husky and Rigid and Hampton Bay, you know, the sailing fan category. And so there was a lot of fun times that we had, but it was, my memories are certainly, you know, about the culture that was created, the respect that we had for each other. We tried to eliminate all bureaucracy and all politics in that organization. And at the end of the day, you know, the inverted sort of pyramid that we call it, where the customer is at the top and at the organizational chart, I guess when they call it the inverted pyramid, it was the organizational chart that normally at the top of any organizational chart, you know, you have the CEO or the chairman. Well, the way we operated our business at Home Depot and the way we operated here is that inverted chart where Arthur Blank or myself sit at the very bottom, and at the top of the organizational chart are those associates that are closest to the customers. I guess the customers would be at the very top, but in terms of organization chart, it's those that are on the floor of our retail stores. Those, I believe, have the most difficult jobs. They belong at the top of the organization chart. They're the ones that feed us with sort of the answers in terms of how to run our business, if that makes sense. We help facilitate here, you know, in sort of our store support center, but took a lot of those same principles here to PGA Tour Superstore. Yes, we've been methodical in terms of our growth, you know, 15-20% store growth since I've been here, but it's a whole different world now that, you know, it's as we'll get into, it's not just, you know, brick and mortar retail now. Certainly the online business creates a whole different dynamic and a whole different distribution channel for us in a way of becoming a national store and not just a local store in 25 to 50 markets. So excited about that. It's something that actually we didn't really have at Home Depot back in 2002. You know, so the world has changed dramatically, but a lot of the same principles that we had at Home Depot apply here, as I've said many times. We've just created a really great culture with, you know, a knowledge base of associates that's so critical, just as it was at Home Depot when our associates are wearing our orange aprons that just happen to be wearing blue shirts. And I think if you talk about the Home Depot brand, you can't help but talk about the service you provide in the stores, the assortments in the stores, the values you get, and it's similar here at PGA Tour Superstore.
You mentioned the inverted pyramid. You mentioned, obviously, the education, the resources that you've got to have available for those associates that are interacting on a day-to-day basis with the customers that come in. For those that haven't been, PGA Tour Superstore is very hands-on, very experiential type of retail. How do you go about ensuring that the associates that are meeting one-on-one oftentimes with the customers have what they need to succeed, and that the educational resources are also there so that they can grow not only within their role, but within the company as well?
Yeah, we have a myriad of training options for our associates. We, in the past, have gathered hundreds of associates and brought them to one area to be able to demo product, try on product, work with our manufacturers. Now it's much more virtual in terms of training. We train thousands of associates every single year on the products. You know, the reality is, and we all know this, is you can Google just about anything and you can find anything about a product. And in our case, you know, and I use other good retailers like REI. I'm a big fan of REI, that when I go into REI, I know I'm going to have value added because that associate knows more about the products than I do. And I can Google and find out as much as I want about the products, but I expect that associate within REI, and the same thing at PGA Tour Superstore, I expect that associate to know as much about the product as the manufacturer. And whether that's Callaway or Titleist or Ping or TaylorMade or Nike or Adidas or whatever. And it's really important that our associates are armed with that kind of information. And that's the value add that we provide. We're not really a commodity. We're not in the commodity business. I mean, we can shop online all day at Amazon, but it's the extra sort of intrinsic value that we provide in terms of knowledge and experience that I think differentiates us. And that's really important for our associates. And the more knowledge they get, the more confident they get, and allows them to grow in their careers through the pipeline and eventually, you know, be in whatever role they want to be.
All right, so let's transition. Let's talk about this last year. I mentioned it earlier, but sporting goods retail has taken off in the last year. Golf is no exception. I think the numbers are something like 6 million people took up golf during 2020. That's not even counting those that came back to golf after having played it and maybe gotten away from it over the years. I know you at PGA Tour Superstore had a record-breaking year in terms of sales. From a high level, what was 2020 like overall for you as a company?
Very unique in the sense that we started off with a good year in February, and then we shut down basically the end of March. And on average, we shut down for approximately 54 days in all stores. It varied. Some markets, the Southeast opened up sooner, the end of April, and the Northeast opened up later in mid-June. And we quickly pivoted in the April and May time period because our stores were closed. The only way people could shop in America, in many cases, was online. So we were innovative. One of our core values is to innovate continuously. And we created, you know, what is known as sort of buy online, pick up in store. But in our case, it was curbside caddy because you couldn't actually go inside the store to pick up. So we created a new way of buying and shopping in our stores, which took off significantly in our markets. But then beyond that, our online business grew at an exponential rate. And we decided during that period that, you know, we're sort of agnostic. We don't care if people buy online or they buy inside of our stores. We prefer them to come in our stores for the reasons we've talked about in terms of the experience and knowledge that they'll obtain. But we expanded our presence, you know, our footprint all over the United States and sort of aggressively, intentionally marketed in markets where we don't currently have stores today. And that was done because, you know, folks all over America, you know, weren't shopping stores again. They were shopping online. So we felt that we would play more in that space. And then we quickly started opening our stores back up. And our main focus was the safety of our associates and our customers. And by mid-June, we saw record-breaking results, not just pent-up demand that occurred in June and July, let's say, from those customers that couldn't buy or shop in April or May, let's say. But it continued all the way through the fall, and great weather in September, I think we benefited from, and the Masters moving to November, which they're playing next week, you know, helped us in the month of November. So we, as you mentioned, we saw a tremendous amount of new golfers, beginner golfers, and those that returned to the game, more than we've ever seen. And the golf rounds themselves were up by over 60 million golf rounds last year. And that trend and that momentum seems to have continued into 2021.
Now, I know a lot of people new to the game, obviously, on the surface, it appears as though, well, it's a slam dunk. It's an influx of business, so to speak. But I know on the ground level, you've installed some initiatives to make sure that you're engaging the new golfer, to make sure that they're not overwhelmed, for example, if they step into a store. What are some of the things you've done surrounding ensuring that that new golfer that steps into a PGA Tour Superstore doesn't get overwhelmed and feels right at home?
Well, first I would say nothing is a slam dunk. And certainly in retail, you know, we fight every day for market share. And I'm really proud of our associates across America because there are some retailers, and I'll go back to, you know, April, where business had shut down, where, you know, they weren't paying their manufacturers for product that had been shipped into their stores. And that pretty much shut down a lot of sales for a lot of other retailers. And specifically, I can say if you went to our website in April or May and we paid all of our manufacturers on time, one of our philosophies that it's a partnership, it's not a transaction, and it's we're in it for the long haul. If you went to our website in April or May and the top 10 items would be available online to buy. If you went to some of our competitors and you looked on their websites and they weren't paying their bills, you might find three of the top 10 items available because manufacturers had shut down distribution to those that weren't paying. And then internally, what was really important to us is, you know, many companies were laying off associates, were furloughing associates, and we took the opportunity to really make sure we were taking care of our associates. There was a lot of anxious times, you know, unemployment was rising, and we made sure that we never furloughed any associates, we never cut pay. We transferred sort of the in-store working hours to online knowledge training hours. And that, I think, separated us, and we came out of this pandemic much stronger than we actually went into the pandemic, because the additional knowledge, the additional training that our associates received was significant and helped us in those following months, as I've mentioned, the June, July, and so on. So I think it really separated us. We don't want to become a company where 50% of our business becomes online. And that goes back to providing sort of the customer service on the floor of the stores or the value added that, you know, we know is so important to our customers. And maybe because we're in a specialty sport, I mean, I wouldn't go buy skis without having someone actually explain to me the centimeters that I need based on the height or based on my weight or the boot sizes that I need based on, you know, do I pronate, do I supinate, do all those kinds of questions that I think people would ask. That to me gets me excited is the extra knowledge that our associates bring. So different, that investment, so different than most other retailers, as you probably have experienced as well. But to answer your specific question, you know, we make sure that we're not an intimidating environment. We don't have commission inside of our stores. So whether you're a beginner or new to the game, or whether you're an avid expert golfer, you're going to get the same treatment inside of our buildings, inside of our stores. The technology that we provide is the same to every single customer, and it's free. You can actually see, you know, how you hit the ball, all of the fitting components of distance and spin rate and ball speed and all that science. You get to see and help you improve your game. Clearly, we stocked up probably much greater than anyone else on beginner sets, and we saw a tremendous amount of box sets that typically, box sets meaning the entire box has all the clubs, the irons, the woods, the bag, and so on. We saw an influx of purchasing there, and so we made sure that we stocked up on those products. So fortunately, we were unable to do the things that we would have wanted to do, like clinics inside of our stores and, you know, still providing lessons with the proper amount of social distancing. So we're different in that sense that we're a one-stop experiential retailer. Any new beginner, anybody coming into the game, you know, was treated with great respect, and we helped them along their journey. The amount of women that have come into this game, and that translates into the amount of families that are playing the game. There's a significant amount of families out there and they're having fun. Obviously, there's a health component that we're all excited about seeing, but people are playing music on golf courses. This new Bushnell wingman that not only plays music via Bluetooth, but it tells you the front, back, and center of the green. So it's, you know, it's multifunction and it's fun stuff. It's not this, you know, stuffy kind of game where everything has to be quiet. You know, a little bit of noise, a little bit of excitement is okay. And if we can get that to change, the 6 million that came into the game last year, if we can provide the environment at the courses, you know, we'll do as much as we can in our stores, but it's really incumbent on those 15,000 golf courses across the US to have a welcoming environment and not intimidating, so people will come back. And I think that's happening. And we hope that this year they'll come back and maybe upgrade their equipment and we'll help them with lessons and get them onto the game in a further way.
You mentioned, of course, the technology in the store, but also when you were reopening, of course, a major focus for you was the emphasis on associate safety, was the emphasis on customer safety. Because of the experiential nature of the stores, what were some of the other adjustments that you had to make surrounding the pandemic when you reopened?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the amount of product that was sort of going outside the back of our store sort of changed the dynamics of our working model. So we had to make adjustments in terms of the operational model, but in terms of safety for our associates and safety for our customers, I mean, all the things that you would think of, you know, from the hand sanitizers to greeters at the front of our stores, making sure that customers had masks if they wanted masks, making sure that we had the proper amount of plexiglass around our registers, make sure that our stores are striped for 6-foot social distancing. So we were wiping down clubs every single minute of the day because we wanted to make sure, given the experiential nature of our stores, that customers that wanted to try a new putter on our large size putting greens, or they wanted to demo or try a new driver, you know, we made sure it was a top priority for us that we kept our associates and customers safe by all the means, and even I would say going above and beyond. And I think we got high marks. You know, I've received numerous letters from customers and associates. We had task force that, you know, included everyone basically in the organization across all functional areas, certainly from our store management and our field management, along with our office here, to make sure that we were addressing all the concerns and all the needs on a weekly basis. And, you know, initially, obviously on a daily basis. And we still have those weekly COVID task force meetings to make sure that we continue to be making the right decisions.
I don't want you, of course, to give away any company secrets, but just looking in the immediate future, what does the immediate future look like for PGA Tour Superstore?
Well, it's a little bit of a company secret, but it's probably not a secret to those in retail and golf specialty retail. With the Masters next week and this weekend with the Women's Amateur Tournament, there's a tremendous amount of excitement around golf right now. I mean, all the new products were launched in February. In fact, more products were launched in February than any other year that I can remember. Some get staggered throughout the year, but because of supply chain issues last fall, many of the manufacturers postponed those 2020 launches, new product launches, and shifted those to February. So this time of year, short term, between March and April, following the launches and leading into the Masters and all the way through Father's Day, we're sort of like in the ski business. This is it. This is our playoffs. This is the time of year when our business is at a peak, no different than, you know, in the ski season, whether it's January, February, our business is pretty much March, April, May, and June. It doesn't mean that it dips off. Certainly it didn't last year, but the majority of the business, the height, the excitement around golf is certainly right now.
We'll wrap up with this. And I like to ask this question of people who have been in retail for a long time. You mentioned you started, you were pushing carts at the age of 16, like I think a lot of us were, certainly at a grocery store. When you leave the industry, when you look back upon your career, what are maybe a few moments or initiatives that you put into place that you look upon as maybe some of your favorite times in the retail industry?
There's one I'll talk about here in a minute. Certainly one of the most exciting times of my life was when I was honored to be selected by Arthur Blank to move out of Home Depot, which at that point was a $60 billion company, I believe, to go help run a local football team. And, you know, the size of that doesn't matter, but for the community, it was really important for us to create excitement. And we were number 32 in about every business metric that you look at in terms of ticket sales and stadium utilization and sponsorship revenue and all the metrics that sports teams look at. And we had come from really a retail background. We weren't in sports. We hadn't been in sports. Now we had been involved in the Olympics. We had been involved in NASCAR and, you know, the NFL on that side of the table. But within a 90-day period, in terms of using one of our core values of listening and responding, and that was listening and responding to the fans. I hadn't been to a football game in 5 years. We're able to sell out the building, and then we broke an 83-year record and an NFL record in terms of attendance, in terms of season ticket holder sales. And so that was back in 2002. But if I fast forward to almost 20 years later, which I can't believe, I'm really excited about a program that we have launched with the First Tee. In fact, I was in Ponte Vedra with my colleagues yesterday with the CEO of the First Tee. And over the last few months, and roughly 30 markets across the United States, inside of our stores, we've been working with students and teenagers from the First Tee, hundreds of students, and helping them with leadership skills, with integrity, with character. And the First Tee is a little bit about golf, but it's really using golf as the metaphor to teach, you know, honesty and character and building sort of life skills, if you will. And we did that through our organization, our team of leaders, our stores taught a curriculum, and 40 of the best students of these hundreds of students are going to go this summer out to Montana, a ranch that Arthur Blank, our chairman and owner, owns. And 40 students are going to go out and experience sort of a dude ranch environment, not just horseback riding and fly fishing and ropes courses, but there'll be a week-long course and classes. I'll be teaching the courses along with others, and a more intense, in-depth opportunity for these students to learn. And then the top four students are going to receive $20,000 scholarships for their future journey into college or whatever university of their choice. So, you know, our organization is values-based, and we're as inclusive as we possibly can be and need to be more inclusive as a sport. And there's lots of initiatives taking place, and we're fortunate to have a great philanthropist in Arthur Blank, who's given over $10 million to the First Tee, and to develop these kind of programs. That, to me, is one of the legacies that I'm excited about, and I hope our journey continues for many more years in the future.
Some fantastic initiatives there, and certainly great to hear. Hopefully that Montana experience is enriching for all, including yourself. But Dick, once again, we thank you for taking the time to join us here today on the podcast.
Trent, thanks so much, and best of luck to you.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Dick for joining us and taking the time out of his busy schedule. I got to tell you, you know, we've talked to a lot of leaders, a lot of CEOs over the years on this show, but Dick, one of the most personable people I've ever talked to, and fantastic. You can see why certainly their sales have done well, but it's not about sales at PGA Tour Superstore. It's about developing associates. It's about developing that knowledge base. It's about reaching out, community outreach, all of those things, and even talking to him off the air, off the podcast, it was very clear he is just so energetic surrounding those topics, and that's one of the main reasons why he stayed where he's been for so long, because again, he loves the culture that he's built there, and he enjoys the fact that he's able to build on that position and what the store is doing for those community outreach projects and to build leadership in future generations. So really neat to talk to him, and certainly hope to have him on the show at some point in the future to check in, if nothing else, to see how that first tee program is going. Well, as we mentioned, our looking ahead story really has to do with looking back, as it was published this last week in Bloomberg that Amazon was exploring potentially opening discount retail stores to sell off maybe overstock home goods and electronics. In theory, these outlets would have basically just marketed the inventory that wasn't selling from Amazon warehouses that might have been stacking up there a little bit, and opening up that ever valuable warehouse space for Amazon warehouse space, something we don't talk a lot about on the show. We talked about it with cold storage a couple of years ago, but it is at a premium in the US, so no surprise that Amazon would want to maybe clear some of that out. And it's an interesting concept because it was apparently scuttled as a result of the pandemic, at least for now, but it's something that a lot of other retailers have seen success with. We've talked about off-price concepts almost being a dominant force for certain retailers to the extent that they almost have to tail them back because they're worried about hurting their main brand. But obviously, you look at TJX, you look at Ross, you look at Burlington, outside of the portion of the pandemic where they were forced to close, absolutely packed with customers during the last 5 years. They've been growing by leaps and bounds. So why not Amazon? And the reason I'm looking ahead to this is the fact that, you know, Amazon thinks these things through way in advance. They've got a real estate team, certainly, that's out there. So I'm kind of encouraged to see what comes of this. And if Amazon has realized that maybe physical stores are the best way to move some of this overstock merchandise or go off price with it, or if they decide to just keep everything digital. But I think it is certainly an initiative that's worth keeping an eye out for. I think it's more worth keeping an eye out for this than it was, say, Amazon's big drone delivery push that they were trying to market around the holiday season about 4 years ago. I think this is certainly a tangible Amazon story that could have an impact on several markets throughout the US. And another thing to note is that this concept could potentially work in more markets throughout the US. Their warehouses aren't always in the big cities like what you see Amazon Go in, the leading markets in the US, but rather you've got warehouses in some pretty far-flung places, in some not really small towns, but mid-sized markets, markets of about 50 to 100,000 people in some cases. So you wonder if those off-price stores might work in those markets, just like the Ross and the TJ Maxx works in those markets. So kind of encouraged to see where this goes, if this indeed goes anywhere post-pandemic. And like I said, from a real estate perspective, very intriguing. And I'm sure landlords, after seeing that article with vacancies of about 20,000 square feet, kind of salivating at the idea of having someone like Amazon taking up vacant spaces if possible. Well, that'll do it for us here on this week's episode of the podcast. Coming up next Sunday, our podcast will feature Anthony Walter of Deloitte. Deloitte released some new numbers recently. Their data comes from the Global State of the Consumer Tracker. We'll talk about the year since COVID, but also the fact that we may be turning a corner not only in the U.S., but worldwide as anxiety levels are going down, confidence levels are going up, and we're excited to continue our partnership with Deloitte by talking about that data next week. Until then, everyone have a great rest of your week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.